Krispy Kreme Drive, just off Veterans Parkway in Washington in Bloomington, serving Bloomington Normal and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. A grand opening taste testing day will be held Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. This is the second hour of the program. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Here this week on the campus of the University of Illinois, there is a major conference that is taking place that is taking a look at the legacy of the Black Power Movement 40 years after. That's something that's being sponsored here by the program in African American Studies. And a lot of people, scholars from all over the country, are here to take part. Yesterday morning, as a matter of fact, on the show, we talked with Kathleen Cleaver, who will be here for the conference, a little bit about some of her experiences. She was someone who was a very important figure in the Black Power Movement. She was in highly placed in the leadership of the Black Panthers and was married to one of the leaders of the Black Panthers. So we had a little conversation with her on the telephone, and she will be here on the campus later in the week and will be giving a talk. So she was just one of the many people who is here for this conference. And here in the studio with us this morning, we have another. He's an historian. His name is V.P. Franklin. He is a professor of history and education at Dillard University, which is in New Orleans. He also serves as the editor of the Journal of African American History. He's taught at a number of different places, at public schools in Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Philadelphia. Also, a rather long list of universities, including this one, the University of Illinois, Yale, University of Pennsylvania, Arizona State, Drexel, Xavier, Uppsala University in Sweden, and also Teachers College at Columbia University. He has written widely on African-American history, and he was here to be involved in this conference to talk about hip-hop, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that, and perhaps a little bit more generally about Black Power, and we're really pleased to have him here on the show. The program here, if you're interested in calling in and asking questions, making comments, it certainly is welcome, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if people are interested in participating, you can certainly do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm very glad to be here.
And we were just, before we got going here, chatting a little bit about the challenges that you all there at Dillard have faced because your campus was underwater after Katrina, and now you're operating out of a hotel.
Yes, the Dillard University campus is located in the Gentilly section of New Orleans, and the Gentilly section was one of the areas that is near one of the canals that breached and had up to 10 feet of water. The entire campus was inundated by the flood waters up to 10 feet, and all of the buildings, etc., suffered damage. And so at the present time, they're in the process of trying to gut buildings and restore buildings in order that we would be able to move back to the campus by September, at least in some of the buildings. Currently, we're operating in the Hilton Hotel in New Orleans. We were spaced at Tulane University to hold classes, and Tulane wasn't damaged as much. Tulane had about $100 million worth of damage, but unfortunately, Dillard University, which is much smaller, had $400 million worth of damage. And the officials at Tulane offered to allow the Dillard to hold classes on their campus, but the problem arose about how the students would go from staying in the hotel, because Tulane didn't have any dorm space for the students, so they would have to stay in hotels, and then they would have to go to Tulane campus to attend classes. And so the decision was made that they should stay in the hotel and then use the conference areas in the hotel. We don't think about it, but you hold conferences in hotels all the time, and so you can have classes in there as well. And so the students and faculty members are living in the hotel, and we are holding classes in the conference area at Hilton. And we're desperately trying to do what we can to raise money to help support the rebuilding process, and so that we can get back onto the campus by September.
And how many? But before the flood, how many students were there at Dillard?
There were 2,300 students at Dillard. It's a small, predominantly black liberal arts college, one of the best, I think, in the country, and it had 2,300 students. And when we were making arrangements to bring the students back for the new abbreviated school year. We were hoping that perhaps 500 or 600 students would come back, and we're actually making arrangements for 500 or 600 students to come back. But actually, over 1,100 students came back. So, in other words, 50% of the students came back in January and are at Dillard University currently.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it's an enormous, enormous challenge.
Yes, it is. It's an enormous challenge for all of us. But at the same time, one of the things that we were able to convey to the students that this is a very important, it's an important period in New Orleans history, Louisiana history, United States history, and they will be there at the epicenter, at the center of this challenge that exists for the entire nation, and that they can, in effect, not only witness what is taking place in New Orleans, but they can also participate in trying to rebuild the city and rebuild the community. And so that it's a wonderful opportunity for the students, not just at Dillard, but Xavier and Tulane and Southern University that are also located in New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the subject here that you were here at the university to talk about, you and an awful lot of other people. And I think the idea behind this conference was to acknowledge the fact that the Black Power movement had a very significant impact on the history of the United States and on the experiences from that point to this of African Americans. And if you look at the things that have happened, going back to emancipation, that I think some people would be prepared to argue that this period and these people were one of the most important things that has happened. Having said that, I realize this is an awfully large question, but in what ways do you think that the fact that this movement existed, how did that change the lives of, in what ways did that change the lives of Black Americans?
Well, the Civil Rights Movement, of course, was extremely important for ending the legalized segregation, the apartheid kinds of conditions that existed in the United States. And the overall thrust of that movement was to break down barriers that prevented African Americans and other people from entering the mainstream of American society, to break down the exclusion that existed. But at the same time, in the process of integrating American society, many, many African Americans, and particularly young people, began to realize that American society wasn't perfect, and that there were a number of problems associated with American society, and that did we necessarily want to integrate into those negative aspects of the militarism, the capitalism, there are elements of American society that are problematic, and at the same time there are elements of African American history and culture that they did not want to be necessarily assimilated into American society: black language, black art, black music, black theater, drama. I mean, those are the things that are part of African American culture that is a gift not only to African American people, but a gift to American society and a gift to the world. And so if integration means that we would have to give those things up and in order to become full first-class Americans, many African Americans in the late 1960s rejected that. They said, "No, we need to use our strengths and our resources to maintain our culture and allow our culture, the things that we created, the language, the art, the institutions, the religious institutions, the cultural institutions that we created, determine what it is that we would want to pass on to our children and what we would want to give to American society." society and what we would want to give to the world. And so those who were advocating black power wanted blacks to be in a position to determine their lives and destiny in American society and to create institutions that would allow African Americans to control their own lives and destiny in American society. And so you had, and in all these different areas of American life and African American life, you had a resurgence, a renewed consciousness, a renewed sense of African contributions, African-American contributions, not just to the United States, to the world, and a feeling of solidarity within African-American communities around issues that were important to the community, such as the schools. And so during the Black Power era, you had an emphasis on community control. And there was a problem that was associated with certain schools that were where the teachers were insensitive and, you know, they were not the children were not achieving and they were disconnected from the community. That you had outsiders really coming into the community and making decisions about how African-American children would be educated. And so during the Black Power, part of the Black Power era, you had a renewed emphasis on community control over the input of black parents and black teachers and administrators having more to say about what went on in schools in the African-American community. And so and that emphasis on community control that African-Americans were concerned with then spread to other groups that were more interested in having more say about how their children were educated. The other area where black power, of course, manifested itself, you know, in a fairly broad and obvious way was in the political arena. Mm-hmm. And so you had the creation of the first election of the first black mayors. As a result of black political mobilizing. Because once you had the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, then you had previously disenfranchised black voters now participating in the electoral process. And in many states in the South, for example, you had the first African Americans elected to political office since the Reconstruction era, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, etc. And so and all of that came out of an understanding of black power, meaning black liberation through political participation. And so that and you also had, which is an interesting story, you also had the demand for the creation of a separate black political party. And so there were various black political conventions held in Newark, in Philadelphia, in Gary, et cetera, that debated the issue of how this newly mobilized black voter would use the new power that was created. Would they use it to create a separate, independent black political party, or would they use this power to support individual black politicians who would be part of the Democratic or the Republican Party. And so that was a big debate. That was a big debate that took place in the early 1970s about how this new black vote would be used. And we know what occurred. That is, you had the leaders of the Democratic Party going to these former civil rights leaders and black power leaders and saying that, oh, well, we want you to run as a Democrat and in the Democratic Party. These former civil rights leaders then became Democrats, and black political power and black vote was then transferred to the Democratic Party, and it was sort of like sealed. That is, the black independent black political party movement sort of died out and was sealed by the mid-1970s with the election of Jimmy Carter, because it was at that time that blacks had made the decision to support to join the Democratic Party and to support Jimmy Carter. And as you know, there were a number of former, such as Andrew Young, a former civil rights leader, who were part of the Carter administration. And so from that time forward, you had this strong connection and support between the new much expanded black voting population and the Democratic Party. And so black power mobilized the black vote on the back of the Voting Rights Act. And so you went from a situation where you had maybe 20, 30 black elected officials in the United States to now like almost 10,000. And so that is so in terms of a legacy of the Black Power movement, that is one that you can point to directly. Another, which is the one that we are sort of celebrating at the University of Illinois as part of this conference, is the creation in higher education of black studies programs. And this came about directly as a result of the increase in the number of African-American students on college campuses in the United States, predominantly white college campuses, in the late 1960s. Following the assassination of Martin Luther King, many universities made a commitment, because of the riots, et cetera, that had occurred and all of that, and they made a commitment to increase the numbers of African Americans on college, on their campus. And once they brought those African American students to the campus, the students themselves did not find themselves reflected in the curriculum. The university, as far as they were concerned, was far from universal. That is, in terms of its dealing with the experiences and cultures of peoples in the world. And they mobilized and engaged in various kinds of campus protests and sit-ins and marches in order to increase the number of black students at these universities, to increase the number of African-American faculty and administrators at these universities, and to call for the formation of various types of black studies programs. And so you have literally hundreds of black studies programs on colleges and university campuses around the country today, and all of them can be traced directly to the Black Power movement. So when we speak of the legacy, the African American research program that you have here at the University of Illinois came out directly out of the protests that took place here at the University of Illinois in 1968-1969, which is documented in a book by Joy Williamson, published by the University of Illinois Press on Black Power on Campus. And so that really documents. So that's one of the studies that have been done to document, you know, the changes that occurred as a result of Black Power on Campus. There are a few other schools that have been documented, University of Pennsylvania, NYU, Cornell University, but the rebellions occurred just across the board in hundreds of schools across the country, and we have hundreds of African American studies and black studies programs. And so we still have a lot of research to do, you know, mm-hmm. to document black power on campus and on these campuses around the country that led to the creation of these programs. Another area where black power manifested itself and represents a continuation today is in the area of black theology. The black theology, the rise of the black theology movement, those who, such as James Cone and Cornel West and others who were associated with the black theology movement, believed that the Christian doctrine had to be understood in relation to the experiences of oppressed people in general and to relate it to the experiences of African American people in the United States in particular. In other words, as far as the black liberation theologians were concerned, that the Christian doctrine, the reason why Jesus Christ came, was to help the poor, to help the oppressed, to help the downtrodden, and that should be the thrust of Christianity as it operates among people of African descent. That is, to help relieve those who are oppressed, to help those who are poor, and not be a religion that is emphasizing otherworldly issues. You'll get your reward in heaven. There's no need for you to worry about your conditions here on earth, because you will get your reward in heaven, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the black liberation theology is sort of like the religious version of Black power. And so its legacy is multifaceted and extremely important.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just let me introduce again, is V.P. Franklin. He's an historian. He's a professor of history and education at Dillard University in New Orleans. He also serves as the editor of the Journal of African American History. He is one of a number of scholars from all over the country that are here right on the campus of the University of Illinois at the moment to take part at a conference looking at the legacy of the Black Power Movement. This is sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program here at the University of Illinois. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You know, given the fact that some, at least, of the groups that were part of the Black Power Movement had a very strong nationalist kind of orientation, a Black nationalist orientation, some of them even separatist. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those people would be surprised at the extent to which the movement ultimately had impact in politics, in higher education, in popular culture, and so really did change life in mainstream America, not just for Black Americans, but probably for all Americans?
Yeah, I think that they would be surprised. I think that those who were members, for example, of the Republic of New Africa, which was a group that was interested in holding a plebiscite in certain sections of the country, you know, and having in the Black Belt areas of the country, and have a plebiscite to determine whether or not people of African descent should remain part of the United States, or whether or not they should create a separate nation, and so that they, you know, so that they were really, really separatists. And I remember when I was a student at Harvard at the time, and some of the members of the Republic of New Africa came, and they discussed this idea of this plebiscite to determine whether or not Blacks should have their own nation, and that they wanted to return to Black people certain states: Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, possibly South Carolina, and hold this plebiscite and determine whether or not there should be a separate Black nation. I remember I thought that was an interesting concept, and I thought it was that's interesting and all of that. And I said, but when I left the meeting, I sort of said that, that's sort of interesting. I said, but, you know, I think that I would want 5 different states. I don't necessarily want those states. I think maybe we should have New York, California, Pennsylvania. You know, they say, oh, no, we want those. I said, well, I don't know about that. So in other words, those individuals were really separatists, and they were not interested in necessarily affecting the larger society. However, the spillover from the entire Black Panther movement was seen in among all of these other minority groups in American society. You had the Chicano movement in California and in the Western states, and you had the similar kinds of organizing by Chicano students, and the creation of Chicano studies programs in numerous universities where you had large numbers of Chicano students. You had the Young Lords, who sort of modeled themselves after the Black Panther Party, which was a Puerto Rican self-defense kind of organization, the American Indian movement, you had a revival sort of among the Native Americans in the United States, and so I think that the leaders of the Republic of New Africa may not have had that in mind when they were making their demands, but it had that effect, because these other groups recognized that their culture and their values and their languages and their institutions were extremely important, and that they needed to be supported not just by their own community, but by the larger society, by the government of the United States as well, because they contributed to American society. They were part of this society, and that the society was plural, and we should focus on pluralism, and that to the extent that these institutions are part of this pluralistic society, therefore these cultural, social, educational institutions should also be supported by the United States government as well. And so they said that, well, if you're going to support and create cultural institutions, museums and theaters, you know, and other cultural institutions for African Americans, well, you can do the same thing for Chicanos. You can do the same thing for Asian Americans. You had the Asian American movement and the creation of Asian American studies in the United States as a result of this desire not to be a fully as the United States. You know, the old idea was that the United States was a melting pot. And so that, you know, eventually, you know, everybody will melt in and you will blend and you will have, a new American. But what the Black Power movement was, and to an extent, the Civil Rights movement sort of supported that kind of notion in terms of integration, of being integrated into American society. What would remain of African-American life and culture if African-Americans are completely integrated into American society? So this melting pot kind of metaphor was sort of a part of it. But with Black Power and these other cultural movements, they say, no, the United States is more like a salad bowl. You know, it's more like a salad bowl. I mean, you have a salad and they're all in the bowl, but you have tomatoes, you have lettuce, you have carrots, and they're all distinct. But together, it creates a wonderful taste. But at the same time, you can pick out the tomato and that's a tomato and that's a, and so that you maintain the essence of those individual substances within the society, and so that it was a plural society. And as Harold Cruz, the African American intellectual, put it, the United States should be plural but equal. That is, it should have all of these different cultural groups supported in the society, but they should be treated equally. And I think that was the alternative thrust that was coming from the Black Power movement in light of the demands for integration that were associated with the Civil Rights Movement.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that in someone listening in Urbana on our line number one? Hello.
Yes. I had a two-part question. Wasn't the Black Power movement really part of a larger movement that occurred after the Second World War with the liberation of new nations, with feminism, with notions of equality that spread from many different areas, so that it was part of a larger liberation that was taking place worldwide? And then secondly, when you attribute these good consequences that came from the Black Power movement, wasn't some of it due to the consciousness of the larger white society that that the previous system had been wrong, and that changes were necessary, and that there was a collaboration of many segments of the larger white society that went along with the notion of liberation and Black Power? And I'll turn off and listen.
All right.
The point about the connections of Black Power to larger liberation movements is well taken. That is definitely the case. We know that there were connections between African American Black Power movements and the struggles in South Africa, and the liberation movements in South Africa, the connections between the African National Congress and Black Power leaders in the United States. Black Power organizations supported the Black liberation and freedom struggle movements in Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau. And so that those kinds of liberation movements in general were definitely part of the liberation agenda of those who were supportive of the Black Power movement, because the objective here was to end oppression of people on the basis of their culture, on the basis of their racial identity, etc. And so that in these leftovers from these colonial regimes that were engaged in guerrilla in wars, like to put down these liberation movements, were very, very much a part of what Black Power sought to pursue and support. And at the same time, you had Black Power movements in the Caribbean. You had demands for increased Black participation in the running of the governments in the Caribbean, even though you had the beginning of independence in many of these Caribbean nations. You still had, you know, individuals who were running these countries that were running them in the best interest of the former colonial power. And so that, in other words, you had a form of neocolonialism operating in these in African countries and in Caribbean countries. And so that there was a as part of the Black Power movement in those countries, it was the objective here was to have the actual control of the society be in the hands of the Black people who were the majority of the people in that society, and that the leaders of those society reflect those demands of the Black majority in those society. And so, in other words, there was this demand to get rid of neocolonialism in the Caribbean and the various other parts of the world. The impact, the Black Power movement also had an impact on the Afro-Brazilian population as well. That is it developed a renewed sense of its connection of Afro-Brazilians' connection to Africa and their connections to people of African descent in other parts of the world, and it led to movements. Cultural movement, educational movements in Brazil to document and to celebrate the numerous contributions, the major contributions of people of African descent to Brazilian society and culture, and to preserve and acknowledge and to promote that in Brazilian society. One of the problems in Brazil was that, I know when I was in Brazil and doing research down there on Afro-Brazilian movements, I was interested in documenting the impact that the Garvey movement of the 1920s had on Brazil, on Afro-Brazilians in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro and other parts of Brazil. And when I was down there and the Brazilians would, you know, they would tell me the things that were part of Brazilian culture, the food, the language, the celebrations, the dance, these kinds of things. And I say, well, I say, but that seems to be Afro-Brazilian. And they say, yes, yes, but it wasn't, it was considered Brazilian, but it was actually Afro, it was the food, the language, the dance, the music was really Afro-Brazilian, and but it was accepted as Brazilian culture. And the problem was, and the acknowledgement that this was African. That this was Afro-Brazilian, so the Afro-Brazilians wanted that acknowledgement. They wanted wanted people in Brazil to know that this that the things that they defined as Brazilian were gifts of Africa and people of African descent there. And so the Black Power movement, you know, raised their level of consciousness about their connections to Africa and Africa's gift, not to the Americas and the gifts to Brazil, and to, for them to feel better because African people of African descent in Brazil were much worse off than people of African descent in the United States in terms of poverty levels and lack of education, et cetera. And so this was but there was also a negative feeling about Africa and a negative feeling about being Black. And so that the recognition that all of these things that are defined as Brazilian are really Afro-Brazilian was a source of pride for Afro-Brazilian people. And so that this then could serve as the beginning of a recognition of their contributions to the society and an increase their positions in educational institutions and cultural institutions, et cetera, in Brazil. So that the impact of the Black Power and its connection to these ongoing liberation movements was there and has been documented and needs to be documented further. And one of the things that's going to be addressed in this 4-day conference here at the University of Illinois is to look at some of those linkages between black power advocates and groups in the United States and these various other African liberation movements. Mm-hmm. Now, with regard to the second part of his question about the recognition of certain groups, white groups in American society, politicians, et cetera, that there were problems and that there was a need to address these demands that were being made by these people of African descent about changing social conditions, political conditions, et cetera. I think that this was definitely the case, and so you had sympathetic groups that were associated with the New Left movement of the 19th, and so that you had, you know, those, for example, who were engaged in the Peace and Freedom Party, which ran candidates for president in 1968, et cetera, and you know this was closely connected to the Black Panthers and other Black nationalist groups, et cetera, who recognized that there were problems in American society, America, the militarism, the war in Vietnam, and that the oppression and the disfranchisement of people of African descent that existed in the United States was a manifestation of these negative aspects of American society. And so as part of their desire to improve, to change American society, they said there's a need to embrace, to support these demands for African-American studies, these demands for the increase the number of black students in institutes of higher education, the demand for greater black input in the running of schools that were located in black neighborhoods. And so that cooperation on the part of the larger white society was really important to get to obtaining many of the objectives that the leaders of the Black Power movement sought. In some instances, the whites who embraced this new black power benefited to some extent more than the blacks themselves, as in the case of the Democratic Party, because they then had all of these individuals who joined the Democratic Party, became political leaders, brought all these black votes into the party, and for those, you know, and particularly during the Carter years, were really important in the Democratic triumph that existed in the politics nationally in the 1970s.
Mm. You know, one of the things that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about, and I realize again this is a large question, obviously, but and that is the kind of connections that existed between the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. And I think the story that we have all been given is that these were two distinct movements with their own agendas, almost in some cases antithetical to one another, at least that the leadership of the two movements were very suspicious about the others. You know, the Black Power people thought the civil rights people were too conservative, too accommodationist. They were moving too slowly, and that the leaders of the civil rights movement looked at the people in the Black Power movement and thought that they were too young, they were too brash, they were too radical, they were too provocative, and they should just cool it. Because that they were going to push way too hard. So, you know, that's the and that's the vision we get of these two sort of opposing camps with this view of each other that really didn't have very much to do with one another. And I think, in fact, that the truth is that it's not nearly quite so clear cut and stark as that.
Yes, I would think that it's not quite as stark as that. And as historians, we have to figure out how to deal with these two periods, or whether or not they're actually two periods, mm-hmm. and as part of this larger black freedom struggle. That is, historians have sort of said that, okay, we had a larger black freedom struggle, and we can trace that from the early part of the 20th century, and that it had these various phases, and so that Garveyism represented one phase of this. The don't buy where you can't work movements in the 1930s was another phase of it. The March on Washington movement led by A. Philip Randolph during World War II was another phase of this movement, and then we have the modern civil rights rights movement beginning in the early 1950s, representing another phase of this movement, and the Black Power movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s, another phase of this larger Black freedom movement, and so there are connections. I've had, as a historian, we have to deal with periodization. And we have tried to deal with this in some of our publications. For example, my book, My Soul is a Witness, A Chronology of the Civil Rights Era, 1954 to 1965, which came out in 2000, looked at the civil rights era in the United States. And we made the argument, because we looked at civil rights activity across the country, not just in the South, but throughout the United States, and looked in areas of public accommodations, voting, education, the military, religion, et cetera. And we gathered newspaper articles on civil rights activities from around the country and published summaries of newspaper articles from the New York Times, from Jet Magazine, from the Southern School News in the book in order to document these civil rights activities across the country. And on the basis of that research, which ended up with a manuscript of 1,600 pages, on the basis of that research, we defined the period from 1954 to 1965 for United States history as the civil rights era, because we could document civil rights activities taking place around the country. So that was for the United States. But for African American history, the civil rights era is joined with the Black Power era, because you have the same individuals, the same groups, etc., involved in both civil rights and Black Power. Mm-hmm. And whereas in 1965, in the larger United States, you had other social movements that were vying with Black Power for the attention of the American public. And so you had the student rights movement beginning in 1964 with the Berkeley sit-ins and then spreading around the country, sort of 65, 66. So you had the student rights movement. You had the anti-war movement, Anti-Vietnam War movement. So, and you also, that's competing with civil rights, competing with Black Power, et cetera. You had the women's liberation movement occurring at the exact same time. So you couldn't define the United States as a whole as being engaged in civil rights when African Americans were preoccupied with Black Power and the larger society was dealing with women's liberation and, you know, Puerto Rican liberation, Chicano movement and the anti-war movement and student rights and all of these things. But in terms of the civil rights movement, in a subsequent book that I co-edited with Professor Betty Collier Thomas at Temple University called Sisters in the Struggle, African American Women in the Civil Rights-Black Power Movement, we then said that within African American history, we need to put those two together as phases in the larger Black freedom struggle, but that they need to be connected because you have the same individuals who are engaged in the civil rights movement who are also taking up the banner of Black Power, such as Stokely Carmichael, who was a member of SNCC, and SNCC then becomes one of the leading organizations that was associated with Black Power. That was a civil rights organization that became one of the leading Black Power, voices of Black Power. Same thing with the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, a leading civil rights, led the freedom rides in the early 1960s, et cetera, and was very much a part of the integrated civil rights movement and organizations, et cetera, in the early 1960s, but eventually became a organization that was dedicated to Black Power. Same individuals moved from emphasis on nonviolent direct action protests to demands for Black control of Black life and Black communities and institutions that were associated with Black Power. So that there is a continuity there. Mm-hmm. However, they are distinct. They are the hyphen is important because the Black Power is distinct from civil rights movement, and in that way we sort of look at it in we can think of it as being similar to the earlier New Negro movement that occurred among African Americans in the post-World War I era and in the 1920s. And the as a result of participation of African Americans in World War I and the black soldiers fighting in World War I, et cetera, you had what some, what W. E. B. Du Bois and others refer to as a new Negro emerge from World War I. The experience of having to go somewhere else to fight for rights for people in Europe that were being denied, people of African descent in the United States, was unnerving and was something that these soldiers really would no longer wanted to no longer support it. And so many leaders and average African Americans said, okay, the old Negro was a casualty of the war. For at the end of the war, you had a brand new Negro has entered the scene. And this was a shift in consciousness. And that the old Negro that was accommodationist and conservative and moderate in social issues. And here, if you want to, you know, want to pick out a kind of a personage that would represent the old Negro in the minds of these new Negroes, it would have been Booker T. Washington. Okay? And so that they would say, oh, that was the old Negro. The new Negro is militant and radical and is interested in a number of different things. But the new Negro movement manifested itself in all these different ways, as did Black Power. You had new Negroes that were members of the NAACP who wanted, you know, integration, wanted end of lynching. They wanted to, you know, to integrate it in American society. So you had new Negroes who were integrationists. You had new Negroes who were communists, who were part of the new communist movement that was developing in the United States. And they believed in, they created the African Blood Brotherhood. It was addressed in black self-defense. And they were wedded to communist liberation and communist and socialist movements in the United States. You had new Negroes who were socialists, who were interested in having black workers join with white workers to make demands on for improvements for workers in the United States from the capitalist class. And so A. Philip Randolph, for example, in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was a major labor leader, and he was trying to convince black workers to support and join the organized labor movement and in order to usher in you know, a socialist state in the United States that would be a social welfare state, et cetera, and that black and white workers together would improve their situation and make certain demand on the capitalist. So you had new Negroes who were socialists, but the largest number of new Negroes were Garveyites. The Universal Negro Improvement Association had far more members than any of these other organizations and groups, and Marcus Garvey was interested in black self-determination and it was a separatist and was not interested at all in being integrated in American society and wanted to create black businesses and black institutions and schools and universities and other things and to connect black people around the world together and create a separate black world economy. And so you had these new Negroes, this shift in consciousness that occurred following the war, but it manifested itself that is, I'm a new Negro and I'm an integrationist. I'm a new Negro and I'm a socialist. I'm a new Negro and I'm a Garveyite. And there were clashes. Mm-hmm. There were clashes in it. So that was a major shift in consciousness that occurred. The similar thing occurred with Black Power. Black Power is different. There was a shift in consciousness. It was no longer an emphasis on being integrated in American society. It was how black people can come together to try to improve their situation and also to promote their culture, promote their institutions, etc. But as was the case with the New Negro Movement, you had all of these different definitions of black power. What does black power mean? Well, black power means black capitalism. You know, it means that we have more black businesses, and you know, and so yeah, and so you develop connections with corporate America, and then you create all these black billionaires. That's a definition of black power. And others said, no, black power meant black liberation for and support for oppression and a change in the economic structures in American society so that the wealth is shifted from the haves to the have-nots. So that you had this, for example, the Black Panthers, of course, were closely associated with Marxist organizations, et cetera, and they were anti-capitalists. So you had black power advocates that were black capitalists, and you had black power advocates who were anti-capitalists and wanted to see the overthrow of the capitalist system in the United States. And so black power meant a number of different things to different people, and so therefore it manifests itself in all these different areas of black life. And the purpose of this conference is to begin to document these different areas where black power manifested itself.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And as with a lot of things, much more complex than it might seem right in the future. We're almost at the point we have to stop. I was really interested in having you talk a little bit about hip-hop. I don't know if we really can. Give me a minute and tell me what really interests you about hip-hop.
Well, the Journal of African American History has did a special issue in the summer of 2005 devoted to the history of hip-hop. Since the movement is over 30 years old now and it has history, we sent out a call for papers and got responses and published this special issue on the history of hip-hop that attempted to identify themes and patterns in hip-hop that developed over the years. And what these scholars recognized was that in the earlier years of hip-hop, in the late 70s, the early 80s, etc., you had a much more socially conscious hip-hop that was interested in the collective improvement of African-American community, African-American life and culture in American society, and that eventually this more socially conscious hip-hop was overtaken by the gangster rap. And the gangster rap was taken up by the larger commercial interests in the United States, and this gangster rap represented materialism and bling bling and gangs and other negative, the thug life as they call it, and that as a result the hip-hop then is no longer a way for the young people of expressing themselves and at the same time improving themselves and improving their community and improving the larger society, that hip-hop becomes just another materialistic, individualistic philosophy that is no different than rugged individualism in American society at large. And rugged individualism was not what got African American peoples from where they were in American society to where they are now. That was done by working collectively in solidarity with each other to try to prove our situation. So there's a division in hip hop, and we documented that division and hopefully paved the way for more support of those who want to use hip hop to improve the situation for African American youth in American society.
Well, I am very sorry to say we must finish because we're at the end of the time. Our guest, V.P. Franklin, is a professor of history and education at Dillard University in New Orleans. He also serves as the editor of the Journal of African American History. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our program here, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Their catering department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual